Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Walk into the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, and you can see the earliest known surviving photograph anywhere in the world. Steps away is a Gutenberg Bible, one of only five complete copies in the United States. And this fall, you can find a collection of more than 100 sketches of Texas and the American West by artist Frank Ray. This is Think on KERA, broadcasting all this week from the studios of KUT in Austin. I'm Chris Boyd. What I've just described is easily worth a trip down from North Texas to Austin, but in fact, it is just the tip of the iceberg. After six decades in existence, the Ransom Center has acquired 36 million literary manuscripts, a million rare books, 5 million photographs, and personal archives of luminaries from Woodward and Bernstein to Gabriel Garcia Marquez. All of it is made available to researchers who come from across Texas and around the world to gain insight on the creative process. Stephen Ennis is director of the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I mentioned just a little bit in my introduction, but can you give us a broader sense of the scope of the collections you have at the Ransom Center?
Well, the scope is truly fathomless. The collections range fields of human inquiry, from history of science and theology, botanical books, literary archives, works of photography. The collections go on and on. There's been some evolution, actually, in how the collections have emerged and how a focus has emerged over the years. But in the early days of the founding of the Ransom Center, the institution was collecting very broadly and very, very actively in disparate fields. But with time, we've really come to focus our energies most sharply on human creativity. And so what you often encounter now at the Ransom Center, or what you hear about in terms of new acquisitions, are the works of celebrated creative artists, whether in literature or theater and performing arts or film or photography.
And you have personal correspondence as well as professional documents?
We do. And, you know, certainly there's great interest in the lives of artists. But you know, speaking personally, I'm not interested in art that's not coming from some lived experience. And I think often the life, in fact, amplifies the art in some way. So letters and personal documents, diaries, things of this kind are of great research interest to students and to the scholars that are a primary audience that we serve.
How does it work with a living donor, someone who says, yes, I will give you my papers, my correspondence, my documents, but I'm still acquiring them?
Yeah, so the Ransom Center, you know, really was among the first institutions nationally to move in the area of collecting contemporary figures. It used to be in earlier times that an institution, a library or a museum, would wait until someone was completely dead before acquiring their archive. But the Ransom Center, for a variety of reasons, began collecting the work of living figures. And as your question suggests, that introduces all kinds of complexities into the relationship and the issues that arise and have to be negotiated. I will say each individual is different and responds to this act of being archived in a different way. And part of what we end up doing is responding to the concerns, the fears, the apprehensions, and also celebrating the individual's work. We actually have something very powerful to offer a living figure. And, you know, essentially what we're saying when we acquire the work of a creative artist is that we believe your work is going to be studied for generations to come. In a sense, we're offering them a kind of posthumous life that is hard to come by any other way.
What have you learned about the kind of things people hang on to?
Well, that too varies widely. And, you know, there are certainly oddities that creep into the archives of different kinds. Locks of hair in the 19th century would be quite common. Clipped autographs that seem to have some kind of a emotional power for the collector. Curiosities can creep in, but fundamentally what we're interested in are those materials that illuminate the creative process, and that often tends to be drafts of literary works, things that have been struck through and rethought and revised and changed. And what those types of materials give you is really a very intimate and very privileged look at the writer at work. And so the research value of these materials is always paramount.
I would have to imagine there are times when it feels almost transgressive to have an early draft of a work that has, you know, become part of the canon of literature, to see what it might have been and yet what it isn't.
Yeah, you know, it can be shocking at times. It can also be tremendously liberating, I think, for our students. And speaking to the student experience in particular, I think many of our students encounter the great writers, the great canonical figures as established and, you know, concrete text.
Sprung from the mind of Zeus.
Sprung from the mind, tablets brought down from the mountaintop, what have you. And what the experience of seeing drafts can show you is the discipline and the work and the labor and the mistakes and how one learns from mistakes. So that can be a transformational experience for an undergraduate to have, or a graduate student, or frankly for a senior scholar who's visiting the archive for the first time.
The largest single collection is that of David O. Selznick, the filmmaker. And there are really just, I guess, thousands of documents and physical objects. Can you talk a little bit about what's contained in that collection?
Yeah, the Selznick collection documents, you know, David Selznick's extraordinary career in Hollywood. And he did save absolutely everything. When we exhibited recently work related to the making of the film Gone with the Wind, we included artist storyboards, sketches of how the scenes would appear on film long before the cameras captured anything on film. So we see in that case, the collaboration between filmmakers, writers, set designers. You also see there the costumes in that collection, and these were one of the most compelling parts of the recent exhibition on Gone with the Wind. In particular, the green curtain dress that figures so prominently in that story. These two, I think, serve to convey to visitors to the Ransom Center the immediacy of the story that they're there to follow.
It's interesting the way film costumes become so iconic. There are certain ones that we just imagine, and I think about the Smithsonian Institution and the shoes that Judy Garland wore as Dorothy.
Right.
Do you find, in terms of connecting with people who visit the center, that costumes have as much bang for the buck as any sort of piece of visual art that you might display?
Yeah, I mean, costumes can certainly convey the absence of that figure that one seeks to find in the archive. You know, one of the paradoxes is the person that you're seeking in the archive is actually the one that will not be there. But the costume can evoke that absent person in a very powerful way. And I think when I think about our students and the generational change that is coming about in learning, I think that our students often get so much information from a very mediated form of a computer screen or an iPhone or what have you. And part of what a costume or a manuscript draft or a letter, even a typewriter that an author wrote on, part of what it conveys is a sense of authentic evidence, historical evidence. This is not something entirely alien to us. It's not lost to us. It's still tactile. It's still immediate. It's still authentic. And I think institutions like the Ransom Center perform a very valuable role in giving visitors and students and others that kind of authentic experience of the past.
You are, in a sense, competing with memorabilia collectors, not only people who like film and entertainment industry things, but there are people who would collect drafts of manuscripts, that sort of thing. What's your feeling about people who want to possess these things for themselves? Is that something that they should be conflicted about? In some ways, they have the very same instinct that you and your colleagues do.
Yeah, we hope those collectors will become friends of the Ransom Center.
So you don't want to irritate them with a critical comment.
No. Well, it's a common impulse. I will say there is a distinction to be drawn, and the memorabilia collector may be collecting objects that are not rich in research potential.
Mm-hmm. They don't tell a story.
They don't tell a story. And, you know, the very messy drafts, you know, the Norman Mailer archive, for example, that's quite vast. No memorabilia collector is going to take on such a thing as that. So we're actually collecting differently from, I would say, the memorabilia collectors, but there are some affinities and there's some common points of connection, certainly.
Tell me about the sort of back and forth courting process between you and a potential donor, and how much that varies depending on whether it's the donor himself or herself, or whether it's heirs or an institution that's had a collection.
Yeah. Well, it truly is. Each is truly different. But I think often there's a sense that of great satisfaction that the work will have enduring life, and that's a flattering and a powerful message that the center can send when we wish to acquire something. But there are those who will view the placement of an archive as something like erecting a tombstone, that the life must be over, that it's a final act. And to those people, I have to offer the reassurance that it's simply an expression of our confidence at a young age, what they're still going to go on and produce. But we inevitably have to decide how we are going to address the real life privacy concerns of living individuals. And one cannot collect the material of living figures and pretend that there are not privacy concerns, what spouses and children and others will think of unguarded moments and confessional moments that may emerge in an archive. But we can negotiate those difficulties because the Ransom Center's interest really is in is a long-term interest. We're really interested in this history coming to light sometime. It doesn't have to come to light today. It doesn't have to come to light next year. But we can close some materials for a period of years if there are privacy concerns, even as we make other material that is less problematic widely available.
My guest is Stephen Ennis, director of the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. It's a research library and archive with collections from artists, writers, and public figures. If you'd like to join our conversation from the studios of KUT, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
20 years after my own graduation, I have come gradually to understand that the liberal arts cliche about teaching you how to think is actually shorthand for a much deeper, more serious idea. Learning how to think really means learning how to exercise some control over how and what you think.
This is Think from the studios of KUT in Austin. You just heard the voice of the late writer David Foster Wallace giving a commencement address at Kenyon College in 2005 that illustrates his private devotion to self-help. We're speaking this hour with Stephen Ennis, who is director of the Harry Ransom Center of the University of Texas at Austin, which possesses the entire David Foster Wallace collection. Steve, I'm sure people aren't surprised that Wallace was a voracious reader. They may be surprised at some of the things that he read and annotated as carefully as anything else in his collection.
That's right. He did have very wide taste in the books that he read. And among the roughly 300 books that we of his that we house at the Ransom Center are quite a large number of self-help books, often popular self-help books, not necessarily works that would pass muster with clinicians and doctors and physicians, but a whole genre of popular self-help that he read obsessively. And fortunately for us, he also marked up these books obsessively. And so one can read the David Foster Wallace his novels, one can read those and his other writings alongside the manuscript drafts that show the labor of his creative process, alongside the works that he was reading, even as he was thinking about questions of self and identity and health and mental stability and well-being.
Are there qualities to those annotations that sort of nod to the kind of footnotes and endnotes that he was famous for in some of his work?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, he, of course, did incorporate notes into his work, and he created texts that were multi-layered. And, you know, the work that remains, I think, for students and scholars to do in this archive is really draw out and tease out some of those connections between the reading and the writing. But the Ransom Center exists to make those connections visible and to make that kind of inquiry possible.
Was the collection, when it arrived, sort of neatly organized and ready to be, you know, placed on the shelves in the archive?
Collections arrive in all different form of order and disorder, and sometimes the most refreshing thing can be to encounter a very unordered archive. If an archive arrives and every piece of paper has been folded and labeled and put in some kind of imagined order, you know that it's been a very scripted kind of process of archiving. And so the disorder actually offers us the opportunity to see things that may have escaped the notice of that circumspection.
Do you actually send archivists to the location where collections are before they're transferred to the Ransom Center? What happens between, yes, I'll give you these things I have the rights to, and, you know, they end up in your loading dock?
Yeah, often we do. Sometimes an individual, a writer, say, will be represented by an agent who will do some of this work on our behalf. But often, if we're dealing with an individual directly, it's important to see just what's there and its condition. And some people actually may not have as fully a formed idea of what their archive might be. And so that visit is often an opportunity to round up materials that may have passed from notice and might be important to include. So we do, my colleagues and I do often visit the writer or the photographer in his or her home and help with that assembly of what the archive is.
For materials that are older and you have some things that are centuries old, how much do you restore, repair if there is damage, and how much do you leave untouched because within those marks and flaws are part of the story of the object?
Within the conservation world, the practice has really changed significantly. And, you know, I think most conservators today would acknowledge that the kinds of treatments that we perform should be minimally invasive, often simply maintaining the physical stability and structure of the object. So we have a very talented and capable conservation lab, and those conservators ensure that the materials that we hold, that we have the privilege of holding, will be here always. And, you know, when we think about those that we serve with these collections and the audiences that they are meaningful to, ultimately the largest audience is always that future audience. And so we take the conservation and preservation role of this work very, very seriously.
I mean, I would think that anyone who, you know, runs an institution would be concerned about, you know, acts of nature, fire, that sort of thing. You have such treasures. How is everything, is it cataloged digitally so that no matter what happens to a physical object, a hard copy, something is preserved?
I wish I could say that we could ensure against all threats and all forms of loss, but ultimately the types of material that we house are highly, highly ephemeral. Institutions like the Ransom Center push back against the ephemeral nature of these materials, whether it's a fading photograph or a dress, a textile object. We have all kinds of strategies for delaying the onset of time, but ultimately these are very ephemeral objects. We do catalog materials, and we take great pride in the level of that cataloging, but that's no substitute for the original object itself. What we're doing more of, as all special collections around the country are, is actively creating digital surrogates. But you cited the figure of 36 million manuscripts in the opening of this conversation. And to date, we've digitized roughly 50,000 objects from our collection.
Doesn't happen quickly.
It doesn't happen quickly, and it doesn't happen without a great investment of institutional resources. But we're creating digital surrogates that can be viewed online from our website. And we're also sharing those freely. We're not locking this content up behind paywalls of some kind, but are interested in getting these digital surrogates out into the world so they can have continued life.
You keep mentioning, and I love this, that students come. There are researchers and professionals, mm-hmm. but there are also people who are students at the university. What does access look like for them? Are there like 500 boxes of white cotton gloves around the Ransom Center? How does this work?
Yeah, you know, I think, we have a very active program of outreach to students. Often, the student first visits or may first visit because of a faculty member who's incorporating these wonderful materials into a classroom setting. And that's a useful introduction because it establishes structure and reason for being there and maybe even poses questions that one might profitably explore. But we're also open to the student who's more self-directed and might simply show up at the Ransom Center and after a brief registration process walk in and ask to see the David Foster Wallace collection or the Samuel Beckett papers or the James Joyce corrected proofs of Ulysses or what have you. These materials, we're always balancing the need to conserve and preserve them with the important cultural work that they have to do in the present. And so we want to see them used, and we're delighted when our student community takes advantage of them, or for that matter, students around the state or around the country.
What happens when a very well-meaning individual would like to donate a collection to the Ransom Center that the Ransom Center is not interested in acquiring, isn't in a position to take care of?
Yeah. Well, we've tried to be proactive, and proactive in articulating what we collect and why. And so anyone can go to our website and read how we've defined the scope of what we collect. So if something's offered to us that is not within scope, and this does happen quite often, my colleagues and I often try and direct them to a more appropriate institution. And often the people coming with materials do have things of historical importance, but they may not be a nice complement to the types of materials that are held at the Ransom Center. So we often direct them to other institutions, and that goes a long way to easing the hurt feeling.
We've come into a time in history where we are better able to recognize the artistic and cultural merit of things that come from a variety of traditions, whether those are cultural traditions or socioeconomic traditions. I wonder if the collection has evolved in terms of the diversity of the artists and owners of this content that you are interested in understanding.
Yeah, certainly has been an evolution of the kind you're describing, and I would say an evolution that's still underway. These notions about what is canonical are not fixed for all time, but are highly changeable, and the process of complex cultural negotiations that are still underway. So the Ransom Center, because we collect often living figures, material, we're having to make judgments in the midst of these issues, and we'll make some mistakes, and we'll miss some important figures, but we're also going to have some successes. And you know, over the nearly 60 years of the Ransom Center, we've had a strong record of extraordinary successes, attracting some of the most important cultural objects housed anywhere. It really is one of the elite institutions in the country for this type of very specialized activity.
Can you give us some examples of collections that would reflect that diversity?
Well, we're actively addressing what historically has been a gender imbalance in the representation of our collections. And we certainly have important collections of women writers. The poet Anne Sexton, her archive is one of my favorites in the collection. But historically, and I'm thinking when you look way back over decades, there has been a gender imbalance that the institution has a responsibility to remedy. We recently had the opportunity to acquire the archive of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, which offers a different kind of diversity to our holdings. That acquisition of a Colombian author who spent many years in Mexico extended the geographical reach of our collections in significant ways. We have significant African American holdings, but we could use more, much more. And I think those who are watching the continued story of the Ransom Center can anticipate that there will be continued growth of the kind that I'm describing.
Does the Marquez collection include materials from his time? He worked in advertising, right, to sort of pay the bills for a long time?
He was a journalist. And in fact, he said of his creative work that it was all journalism. There's an element of truth to that. He learned his trade as a journalist writing for the newspapers, and remained in a meaningful way always grounded by that responsibility, that sense of fidelity to truth, even though he was working in a fictional mode.
I know he bristled at the idea that it was all fantasy.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as others have said, you know, the notion of magic realism, which he's famously identified with, the notion of magic realism tends to hit people's ear with an emphasis on magic, but the realism was always there.
Another interesting collection focus that the Ransom Center has is, I don't know if you would consider them authors who happen to also be gifted artists or visual artists who happen to be gifted authors.
Yeah. That's been a focus of the Ransom Center's collection for, since the beginning. And one of the early acquisitions of this kind were the papers and paintings of the novelist D.H. Lawrence, but also the poet E.E. Cummings and many other figures who have worked in more than one genre or form.
Is there a sense that you can more fully understand one when you consider the other, or are there some that seem to be unrelated when you consider them together?
Well,
suppose it's hard to generalize.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think going back to what I said a moment ago, I think that these connections implicitly are there, and you know, the work of those who work in our collections is really to tease out those relationships. I may not be able to do that for you on the air
fine.
At this moment.
I wonder sometimes if it's easy to assume that everything that an important or creative person does must in some way contribute to who they are, what they produce, who they become. Whereas people who don't do creative things or don't go on to do things that make them very famous, you know, we don't necessarily look at every detail of their lives. Do you also, in working at the Ransom Center, do the scholars there have to learn, you know, what needs to be fully examined and then maybe set aside as something that is ultimately just incidental?
Yeah, that's a very specific skill that archivally trained researchers do develop, is some instinct to it, but also it's based on, in some cases, years of familiarity with working in these types of primary source collections. I will say we face a real challenge, I think, in the coming years, because the digital archive is so indiscriminate in what it saves. Essentially, the machine will save everything. That future researchers working in digital archives, which are now arriving in great quantity, are going to have to address quite specifically this challenge of discriminating between what's a fruitful line of inquiry and what's not. And will there be machine-mediated ways to negotiate that remains to be seen.
Let's talk more about that in a couple of minutes with my guest, Stephen Ennis, director of the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. We're broadcasting all this week from the studios of KUT. If you would like to join Think by phone, call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of KUT in Austin, this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for the hour is Stephen Ennis, director of the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin, which is a research library and archive with collections from artists, writers, and public figures, among others. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Steve, no matter what you do, you can follow the best practices. You can set the standard for best practices. And yet technology is evolving in such a way that certainly 15, 20 years from now, the best stuff you do today will be considered technically outmoded. How do you prepare for that financially? And how do you prepare for it in terms of knowing that you will perhaps once again have to bring out documents that have been safely put away?
So this is a change in how each of us works and how creative people work that's affecting all of us who care about the cultural moment and how we preserve that history, that historical record over time. Certainly technology and the new forms of storage of digital content, which are always evolving, pose significant challenges. An institution like the Ransom Center is not just a group of professionals who archive paper. We archive all kinds of objects. We archive photographs. We archive film. We archive sound recordings. And increasingly, we're archiving digital content, the contents of writers' hard drives, their floppy disk, all kinds of storage media that come in with a collection.
Can I interrupt you for just
sure.
a second? Was that something that when it first started to be taken seriously, there were some people who thought, well, it's, you know, the second-class thing to take the digital archive and the real curators of these materials will stick with the hard copies?
Yeah, I think there were a variety of different views in the mid-1980s and the early 1990s when this type of material began to emerge in our archives. And, you know, I'm not betraying any secret to say I once worked with colleagues who would have liked to put their head in the sand and pretend it wasn't happening. But, you know, I think the reaction may have been partly a feeling that the digital object lacks some of the authenticity that I was speaking of
yeah.
a moment ago. And in fact, it's infinitely replicable. There is no artifact there other than bits and bytes on a computer chip. So while it may not evoke the same feeling towards the past that those of us in this type of work, well, it was often a motivating force for why we got into this type of work. It may not elicit those feelings. Nevertheless, there's important content there, information that's worthy of being captured. And in some ways, the digital record is going to become more full than perhaps existed in paper form. I remember visiting the novelist Ian McEwan in his home in England, and I was expecting to find his letters with Salman Rushdie, who's he's known to have been a close friend with. But I wasn't coming to the paper letters among all of his papers. And when I asked about his correspondence with Rushdie, Ian McEwan went, of course, to his computer keyboard and after a few keystrokes pulled up all of his email correspondence with Salman Rushdie dating back to the 1997, which was the year he began systematically saving all of his email communications. That's a tremendously rich resource. In the past, the scholar or the student who sits down at an archive and calls up a box of Ian McEwan's papers found there things that may have survived or may have found things, gaps in that record, things that may not have been saved or may have been thought inconsequential and discarded. But now, after that born digital archive, as we sometimes call it, after that born digital material has been archived and made accessible, it will be a remarkably full record, not only the correspondence that Ian McEwan received, but also that he wrote, both sides of it. And all of it there, very indiscriminately saved, because the computer, frankly, doesn't care about any appraisal of its worthiness for being saved. It's all there. And so I think future historians and literary scholars and others studying our cultural past are going to need to develop new skills for navigating this vast body of material. But ultimately our job is to make sure that it's there to support that inquiry. And we're actively working to assemble the talented technicians and others who have the skill set to capture that very fugitive and ephemeral digital content.
Let's go to the phones now, 800-933-5372. We have Chris on the line in Sunset. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I had the privilege back in the early 80s when I was in Austin and involved with the local theater to do a production of Under Milkwood, and discovered that the Ransom Center has quite a bit of Dylan Thomas's materials. I think his wife donated them. And I just wanted to say, I said it at the time, but I want to say it again here to the director, how much I appreciated being able to look at those materials to see how he had either changed the script or left things alone. I mean, some of the stuff that amazed me was how many times throughout I could tell that he had written a line and never changed it through all his rewrites. So thank you for having that kind of material available and, you know, letting just a theater guy come in and work with it.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for making that point about, as you describe it, a theater guy. You know, we're open to anyone who has curiosity about the types of materials that, that we have the honor of holding. And we serve all kinds of audiences. And the kind of visit that you're describing is something that we welcome, and delighted that you found what you were looking for and found it such a meaningful experience.
I love that Chris pointed out that he was really struck by the things that didn't change over time, because
right.
we can think a lot about what might have been and what got amended, but clearly the parts of works that were intended from the beginning and last are really important.
That's right. And one can read this kind of material evidence in just the way you're describing, the way Chris is describing. Another example of it is the notebooks that came with the Ian McEwan archive. And he, as many of your listeners will know, is the author of the novel Atonement, most celebrated novel, I suppose. And when I was looking through the notebooks for the first time of Atonement, his very earliest drafts for that novel, it became clear that from the very point of origin, he already knew where the novel was going to mm-hmm. end. And that's a revealing thing, to know that all along the author knew from the beginning where he was going to end up. And it colors and shapes how we read all the struggle and the strike-throughs that fall between the beginning and the end.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Gordon in Fort Worth. Hi, Gordon.
Hello. How are you today, Chris?
Great. Thank you.
Hello to Dr. Ennis.
Hello, Gordon.
Dr. Ennis, you've talked about the needs that the Ransom Center has, financial needs to collect and acquire and preserve and display. The archives that is on the hand at the Ransom Center, and I know that you get some money through state appropriations, and it is true that there are no fees to attend. Isn't it true that a large component of what the resources needed by the Ransom Center comes from private philanthropy? Can you discuss how listeners could help the Ransom Center
sure.
fulfill its mission on that score?
Sure, I'm happy to. The Ransom Center receives only approximately 43% of its budget from state allocations that come through the university. The remainder comes from either earnings off of the institution's endowments, which we're fortunate to have some very helpful endowments that have been established by friends of the center over the years, and the remainder by gifts and grants. You're correct. We don't charge for visiting the center. We don't charge for people to make use of the digital images that are available on our website. We're interested, as I said earlier, in these materials traveling far and having a useful life for multiple and varied purposes. So we're not revenue generating in any meaningful way, and only a portion of our funding comes from the state. So we do depend on the goodwill of our members who believe in the work that we're doing and participate in our program offerings for members and the larger community. And dependent as well on the foundation community and friends who, as I say, share a commitment to preserving and caring for the types of history and cultural legacy that we document.
There are, as I understand it, only 5 complete Gutenberg Bibles in the United States, and one of them lives at the Ransom Center. I wonder symbolically what that document means to you. Why, you know, Gutenberg sort of means something even above and beyond the object itself.
Yeah. So the Gutenberg Bible, as you say, it is the copy that we hold here in Austin, is one of only 5 complete copies in the United States. It's a foundation work. It's foundational for everything that was printed in subsequent centuries and everything that continues to be printed. And that's why the work sits in pride of place in our lobby on permanent display for people to come see. Going back to our conversation just a moment ago about the digital medium. I think some people mistakenly think that that people wrote on paper, then printing was developed, and people printed books, and now they work on a computer. That there's been a clean transition from each one of those forms to another, but in fact, these modes of communicating and documenting this ongoing story of human history is multi-layered and overlapping. And one of the objects in our collection that I personally find quite striking is a manuscript that was written around the time that the Gutenberg Bible was printed. And it's a manuscript from roughly 1450 of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. It's not in Chaucer's hand because at that time, the way things circulated was making handwritten copies. And so one would copy what one loved and pass it on to others, and it would circulate in manuscript form. The Gutenberg Bible offered the opportunity to produce books in another machine-made way, set from movable type. But manuscripts have continued to circulate as the Canterbury Tales did around the same time. And they continue to circulate, as we know from the papers scattered around us on this desk here.
Was there one piece of work, piece of art that led you into the world of, you know, research archives?
Oh, I don't think there's any one moment of that kind. I did spend many years working with poets' archives in particular, and I've always been taken by the poetic draft.
Do you still have to fight the romance of the object itself?
Oh, I don't think one fights the romance of the object. I think one gives oneself up to it.
But, I mean, given that, you know, certainly people of your grandchildren's generation won't probably put anything down in the same way that we do, despite the fact that there's an overlap today, that's probably, you know, its days are numbered.
Oh, I'm not pessimistic on that score. I think one of the primal things that each of us does is leave some mark, and the nature of that mark may change, but the Ransom Center is in the business of documenting those marks, and yes, the technology behind it may change, but we'll be trying to capture that lived experience or the evidence of that lived experience in whatever form it exists.
Do you get excited when somebody comes along and really wants to look at like a long neglected item within the archive?
Oh, of course. We love to see the materials used, and it's quite curious sometimes when someone will visit the Ransom Center and discover that we have such and such an item in the collection and call it up, and they'll share with you and with great enthusiasm their discovery. But it's always been here. It's always been here. It's just been waiting for them to find value and meaning in it. And that is a moment of discovery for them and why institutions like this exist.
Stephen Ennis is director of the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. It's a research library and archive with collections from artists, writers, and public figures, with an exhibition gallery open free to the public 7 days a week. Steve, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Lauren Aguirre. Our executive producer is Jeff Winnington, and I am Chris Boyd from the studios today of KUT in Austin. Thanks for listening and have a great day.